It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. A lot of people have had to cancel or alter their summer vacation plans this year. Any travel, of course, carries with it some risk during this pandemic. But camping and road tripping, particularly short trips, are soaring in popularity because they're some of the lower risk options. In many ways, it feels like we've stepped back in time to when road tripping and camping were some of the only options for middle class travelers seeking adventure. The introduction of the automobile at the beginning of the 20th century gave Americans and Iowans a whole new kind of freedom. And this hour, we will take a virtual road trip through Iowa history. With me, Leo Landis. He is curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Hello, Leo.
Good morning, Charity. It's always an honor to be on the show.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. And you are also host of the Iowa History 101 series. It's a virtual learning series, the second and fourth Thursdays of the month at noon. This Thursday, the Iowa State Fair. So you can find more about that at iowaculture.gov. Tom Moraine is also here from the History Department at Graceland University in Lamoni and former director of the State Historical Society of Iowa. Tom, hello.
Hello, and I'm glad that Leo didn't get blown away last night. We were watching the weather reports and wondered where he was going to end up this morning.
Yeah, it was a scary evening in central Iowa. Leo, let's start before the automobile. Let's set the stage a little bit, because, of course, Americans have always had a wanderlust, the desire to travel, to gather, to have adventures. So even before we could go on road trips with cars, people did take little journeys, I guess bigger journeys in some cases, but they did find ways to get around. What were some of the early pre-car kinds of road trips?
Exactly. And so it was always, and still is, you know, determined by how you travel. So with the day trips of the early and mid 1800s and late 1800s, carriages and railroads were the main transportation. And so in 1840, rural cemeteries, or cemeteries as areas to visit, not just burial grounds, were common. The Mount Auburn Cemetery in Boston area was a cemetery that was landscaped to be explored and enjoyed, as well as a place to remember your loved ones. And so places like Aspen Grove Cemetery in Burlington and Woodland here in Des Moines and Floyd Cemetery in Sioux City, those were places that were designed and landscaped to be suitable for day trips and suitable for outings. So that was one of the earliest 1850s, 1860s ways Iowans would spend a Sunday drive in a carriage. And then, of course, railroads come in and really start allowing greater transportation.
Well, and of course, when we think about train trips today, unless we're talking about light rail, you know, we think about something that's a big undertaking. But it wasn't uncommon for people to travel to the neighboring town by rail?
Exactly right. One of the stories I know, an 1874 account of about 600 people from Des Moines, a Sunday school group, coordinating 8 flatbed rail cars to go up to Polk City, just north of Des Moines, about 10 miles, a little less than that maybe. And so spending a Sunday picnic, and a lot of these are focused around religion, sometimes politics, for these weekend picnics or day outings. And then one of the other things, and a story that I've been aware of but just rediscovered in some recent research, one of the ways African Americans in Iowa and other communities celebrated was Emancipation Day. It actually goes back, the earliest one was in Muscatine in the 1850s with Alexander Clark and some of the other African American community members in Muscatine. But there's a great account of the Emancipation Day celebration in Albia, Iowa in 1895, where people from Ottumwa and Oskaloosa and Des Moines and other communities are coming into Albia for the Emancipation Day celebration. And Albia was just around 3,000 people at the time. The newspaper account is really a beautiful account of the crowd is about 6,000 people total going to the fairgrounds, enjoying the community. And the newspaper account from the Albia paper just talks about how it's the, and they use the term Negro or colored, but the African-American community from across the state celebrating, and that the people of Albia, the largely white community of Albia, and it was a mining town at the time, in participating in just a beautiful, beautiful account of Iowans celebrating together in 1895. And that was using the Great Western Railroad for people to get to Albia if you were in central Iowa. Also, if you were in, you know, a place like Ottumwa or in Oskaloosa, might be driving or there would be short line rail as well to get you to a nearby community.
And I just read an account, Rochelle Chase, who is a historian who's done a great deal of work about Buxton, Iowa, also shared an account of Emancipation Day celebrations in Buxton, a particular account from September 22nd, 1862. So, of course, many of us just celebrated Juneteenth, which is an emancipation holiday that started in the South and made its way north. But it sounds like shortly after the Civil War, the celebration in the North was focused on that September date.
And it was, and it actually was being focused early on in that 1850s and even some of the later post-Civil War ones connected to the Haiti independence and freedom of slaves in August. So you sometimes saw those days celebrated in August as well. That Albia event was an August date.
Okay. What a rich part of our history. You mentioned church revivals or religious meetings. And Tom, I'll let you chime in here. Let's talk about some of the kinds of gatherings that would have taken people out on the railroad. And church revivals were a big part of that, right?
That's right. The revivals often went from town to town. The speakers would travel from town to town. They would work with local pastors. They were usually ecumenical gatherings among different Protestant denominations, and the Protestant ministers would work collectively to raise a crowd, and then the guest speakers, the revivalists, come in, and often tent meetings in the evening, but would draw a large crowd for that. Those paralleled the development of the Chautauqua movement, which started out as a semi-religious affair in Chautauqua, New York, a large park, a large campgrounds that people would come and spend a week or two, and there'd be lectures, there would be entertainments, it would be a family activity, and then those became so popular that there were Chautauqua companies, private for-profit groups that would put together programs and move them from town to town. Small towns or moderate towns that could host Chautauquas would bring in these groups. Often farm families came in and camped through the week, or at least the mom and the kids, and then town families could join through the day, women and children activities through the day, and then the more serious stuff at night. But Chautauquas became very popular throughout Iowa. They were an entertainment, but they also had the religious covering of an uplifting educational activity, but really left their mark on the countryside.
And of course, these would be summer activities, right, Tom? Because they had to be outside to accommodate such large crowds or in tents that were erected for them, right?
That's right. And the schedules were that the speakers would go from town to town, follow each other around the Midwest, and if everything worked correctly and the schedules went fine, they could cover a lot of territory through the day or through the summer.
Now, let's talk about cars, because cars, of course, changed everything. And Leo, I'll let you start. And Tom, I know you'll want to add in a few things as well. But when the automobile became available and accessible to middle class families, that was just a huge shift in how we lived, right?
It really did transform, and yes, Tom knows this story really well, too, but transformed how Iowans, men and women, could explore the state. You have really 1910 is when cars start to become affordable for everyone, and reliable is equal, and roads become better suitable for automobile travel, though that continues through the 1930s to be a challenge. And so you see stories in Iowa newspapers. I know in Keokuk, they're talking in 1910 about all the people coming up to Des Moines in their cars to camp at the state fairgrounds as part of the state fair. So by 1910, you really do see automobile travel becoming common and accessible. The Highway Commission, the predecessor to the Iowa DOT, does county maps in 1914, and then the first state map is 1919. So Iowans know roads around their neighborhood, but then can figure out how to get to Clear Lake or Spirit Lake up north on the Mississippi to other vacation spots.
Well, and thank goodness for our grid system,
because
I'm sure not everybody had a map. Tom?
Charity, let me jump in there. We have to remember, in the early days of automobile travel, most town residents didn't travel into the countryside that often. If they needed to get to the next town, they normally took a train, even if it was only 6 or 7 miles. They checked the train schedules, and there were usually a lot of trains coming through the day. So the idea of the roads that you had to take even to get to the next town were an adventure. Gradually, those did get marked out, and they got standardized. But some of those early road guides were done not necessarily with maps, but the kind of directions that Iowans give. Oh, you go 2 miles down here till the Smith Farm, and then you turn right, and you see where the Jones used to live and so forth. But they would have go till you pass the White Barn and then cross the bridge, and those were the instructions that drivers got
right
to get to the next town.
Well, we will talk more about those adventures in just a moment, Tom, because we have to take a short break. We are talking about road trips through Iowa history today. With me today, historians Leo Landis and Tom Moraine. We'd love to hear from you as well. Your favorite road trip destinations in Iowa, your best road trip story. Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're taking a virtual road trip through Iowa history. Of course, a lot of us have had to change our summer plans this year, and a lot of people are hitting the road, maybe for some shorter road trips. A lot of people are going camping because those seem to be the options that provide the least amount of risk during this pandemic. So we're exploring the history of road tripping in Iowa this hour. Leo Landis is here, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa, and Tom Moraine from the History Department at Graceland University and former director of the State Historical Society of Iowa. And you are welcome to join the conversation. Tell us about your favorite Iowa road trip destination or a great road trip story that you remember from your youth. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Tom, just before the break, we were talking about really the adventure that those early road trips provided, because not everybody had access to maps. The roads didn't have names in a lot of places. The directions were based on landmarks and historical knowledge. But also, the roads were terrible, right?
Yes, certainly in the spring, the idea of going at a distance in the spring, you had no idea what conditions the roads would be between where you were and your destination. If you got stuck, then maybe you could get a farmer to pull you out, and you paid to get that pull. But it was not. You waited till summer to do the long road trips because road conditions throughout the Midwest were just not very reliable. One of the advantages and improvements that did a lot for distance travel was the Lincoln Highway that went from Clinton on the Mississippi to Council Bluffs and then on across the Great Plains. But that opened up the Rocky Mountains to Iowa drivers, Iowa families. There was a study done in Yellowstone that farmers, often from the Midwest, were the occupation listed twice as many as any other at Yellowstone tourist or Yellowstone registration spots. Midwesterners were traveling farther distances than they had ever done before, camping along the way, and it spawned a whole industry of tourist cabins, little cabins that you could had a couple beds in them, maybe cooking. The term, if you don't see it very often, but I remember growing up, modern cabins. Well, modern meant that it had indoor plumbing. It was a very specific term that you had. But a lot of families just took along a tent and camped by the side of the road and did their cooking.
That was just acceptable at the time, that you would just stop where you stopped and maybe you'd be in somebody's pasture and put up a tent?
Yep. Along the road, if there was an open spot there or down by a river. A friend of mine took a road trip with his grandparents in the 1950s. He was a young guy. But he remembers his grandmother having a broom and dustpan and cleaning supplies when they stopped at a tourist cabin along the road, probably paid a few dollars for the overnight. In the morning, she cleaned that cabin like it was her own house, and she was going to be judged by it. She got the broom out before they left. That cabin was spotless.
Cleaned it before they slept in it.
No. It was in the spring. It was probably cleaned by the family that came before. But that cross-country travel, that also would relate to Iowans going up to Arnold's Park and the Great Lakes. I'll pitch it back to Leo if he wants to talk about Arnold's Park and Great Lakes and Lake Okoboji and so forth. But I want to talk when he gets done.
All right. So the fact that people could travel and go on these road trips, that began to really change the landscape of Iowa, this leisure landscape of Iowa, because we weren't stuck on those rail lines anymore. And Tom mentioned the Lincoln Highway. We had the Jefferson Highway. But also, we could go to other places. And Leo, I suppose the Great Lakes of Iowa became an early destination.
It was, and I would just want to point out, too, that one of the early bike excursions pre-RAGBRAI was an Iowa bicycling club that biked from Des Moines up to Spirit Lake, and I can't remember the year. It was the 1890s, maybe a little bit earlier, and, you know, it wasn't quite a RAGBRAI experience, obviously, but it was later in the summer, but that's an early outing, and the lakes really did attract folks. Either Clear Lake in north central Iowa and Cerro Gordo County is a beautiful lake, or the east and west Lake Okoboji's and Spirit Lake in Dickinson County, and those were being promoted in the late 1800s. There were rail lines going up there too, so it had developed along the railroad excursions. But as automobile travel becomes more common, renting those cottages that Tom was referencing, both in places like Clear Lake or at the Okoboji's or at Spirit Lake, really becomes a common outing. So you could get from Des Moines up to northwest Iowa by rail in a evening, or by car over about a 6 to 7 hour drive, and you might stop at one of those cottages that Tom was referencing, those tourist cabins, as a place to stop maybe on your way up, so that it wasn't one long slog on those dirt roads. And that really was, as Tom referenced, something that you usually waited. June is our wettest month historically in Iowa, so you were looking at travel right around the 4th of July into August, and if you were a farm family, as Tom referenced, you probably had somebody helping take care of your cows while you're gone for the day, but your corn didn't need to be cultivated. Maybe your oats had been harvested and were waiting to be threshed. And so you really start to see the travel to the lakes as the weather gets hotter and as the roads get better.
Well, and that also allowed, of course, the opportunity for businesses to open up that catered to those tourists, right?
Exactly right. Arnold's Park started actually up at the lakes in 1889 with a water slide going into West Okoboji in 1889. So you've got that as a beginning. But then as you get more formal attractions as well, like roller coasters. What today is known as the Legend roller coaster at Arnold's Park. It opened in 1927. At Clear Lake, 1934, the Bayside Amusement Park is really taking off. Maybe the late 1920s, I think, was when it was starting to be developed. So you started seeing these amusement parks as an attraction for younger people, and as the post-World War One era, as you know, youth culture starts to become more defined as independent, catering to families, but also to young adults and children.
And I suppose that probably paved the way for the ballrooms that we had dotting Iowa as well, the historic Surf Ballroom and some of the other ballrooms where the great bands of the 30s and 40s would travel around and perform. Tom?
Let me add one tourist attraction to the Great Lakes area. Put in a plug for the State Historical Society that owns the Abby Gardner Cabin, or the Gardner family cabin that was part of the Spirit Lake Massacre in the 1850s. But Abby Gardner Sharp, when she became an adult, returned to her home cabin and turned it into a tourist attraction. She was there and sold postcards and trinkets, and you could talk to Abby Gardner about her episode with the episode in the Spirit Lake Massacre. I find that creepy.
It does seem like a really macabre destination. Of course, a lot of people had she published her memoir by that time, so a lot of people had read her book.
I'm not sure when that.
Yes, she had. And again, it's important to recognize the perspective that she brought to that experience, both as a survivor, but also just that band of the Sioux people had really, or the Dakota people had been really persecuted.
The story, as it was told for many, many years, including up through my childhood, was a very one-sided story. And we are hopefully doing a better job telling a more complex story than once was told.
Yes, we are at the State Historical Society of Iowa. Mike Plummer, our sites manager, does a great job working with the programs.
So that it does underline how some sort of bizarre places became tourist attractions, and I'm sure word of mouth spread. Of course, Wald Rug is one of those weird tourist attractions that the people still flock to in South Dakota that was made possible by this road tripping culture. Tom, we've talked about this before. We were talking about the mud on the roads, but let's talk about tires on those early cars as well, because I think people who spend a lot of time on bicycles and go on long road trips, maybe they're on their bikes, are familiar with having tire punctures pretty frequently and learning how to fix that. But that was a way of life for those early car travelers, too.
Yes, you carried patching equipment with you. If there was a hole in the inner tube, you scratched it a little to roughen up the surface, and then applied glue, and then applied a patch, and put that on. But one of the advantages of the early Fords, the early automobiles, were their ease of maintenance. Maybe not ease, but you could do creative things to keep your car running. I remember interviewing a man who remembers when the radiator leaked in his car. He cracked an egg in the radiator, as it hard boiled, plugged up the leak. There was a family a young man who went joyriding in the countryside. They got a flat tire that they couldn't seem to fix, so they took off the tire itself, took out the inner tube, and filled the inside with oats from a neighboring farmer, and got enough oats in it so that if you traveled slowly, the oats would go to the bottom of the tire, and you could limp into town that way. But families learned how to maintain their own cars, because you get out in the countryside and you're pretty much on your own. Tires were a biggie, and everybody traveled with tire patching equipment.
And when Leo mentioned spending 6 or 7 hours in the car to get up to the Iowa Great Lakes region, not all of that 6 or 7 hours would actually be spent driving, probably, would it, Tom?
No, you had some stops. You had some stops along the way.
Some unplanned stops, I'm sure.
Yeah. There were also a lot of picnic stops along the way. There'd be picnic tables or little roadside parks that your family would have a picnic lunch, and you would eat it on the way. But a lot of taking your meals with you and just stopping where there was a spot to have that meal and go on.
And of course, people had to prepare and bring food with them for the most part as well. So I know that a lot of people are doing that again to make their road trips safer. So we really are having some historical experiences this summer. And we've talked about people traveling west. Did they travel east too, or was this just the Western United States held so much adventure and allure that that was the way people traveled if they were going to go on vacation? Leo?
It would a lot of times depend on what part of the state you were in. So if you were living in Dubuque, you might look to Lake Michigan or to the Wisconsin lakes up north in Wisconsin, perhaps. And I know this story from a 1950s story. There was an African-American resort community north of Grand Rapids, Michigan, called Idlewild. And there were a few African-American families in Iowa who lived in the Waterloo area in eastern Iowa who would go to what is the eastern shore of Lake Michigan, near the eastern shore of Lake Michigan. Idlewild's a little in. So you had stories like that. But the creation of Yellowstone as a national park in 1872, it was being promoted through the late 1800s as a destination. So as Tom referenced, where Iowans had that in their memory or the idea of a place to go visit and see that natural wonder. And so railroad excursions were planned and marketed through the 1930s and 1940s until World War II hits. And then it really does become an automobile culture almost exclusively after World War II.
Well, and you mentioned Michigan, Leo, and I read a fact when I was looking at information that really surprised me, because Michigan is the automobile state, but that in 1922, car ownership per capita in Iowa was second only to California.
That's exactly right. And maybe Tom was going to mention that too. And really, Iowa State College at the time did a survey in the 1920s, nearly half the cars owned by Iowans, and sometimes more than half, were Model Ts. They were just so affordable, and as Tom referenced, that they were fairly low knowledge maintenance cars. I mean, once you knew how to take care of one, it didn't take a lot of skill and care. It took some skill, I should say, and knowledge, but you generally could keep those cars moving on your own.
And they were tanks, too. Yeah. Tom?
And a point on that, during the 19-teens, the 1909 to 1914 is often referenced in the term we use, parity, when farm income was roughly equivalent to urban income. And these were good years for farmers. During World War I, prices were high. They had money to spend on things like cars. You get into the mid-20s, and certainly the Depression in the 30s, things are rougher, but those early years coincided with good years for Iowa farmers. Before we get away, I think we also ought to talk about trips to the South, because the Ozarks were a popular destination as well, and they were probably more reachable by automobile than they were. The train lines through the Ozarks weren't as plentiful as they were in other areas, but the Ozarks became a popular vacation, very popular for fishing, hiking, camping, and the going south. Although going south in August had its drawbacks.
Yes, maybe a better time to head north in August. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. We're talking about the history of road trips in Iowa this hour. And of course, we'd love to hear from you as well. Tell us about your favorite road trip destination in Iowa. Maybe your favorite road trip story. We all have some crazy story from those long road trips we took when we were kids. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send emails email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. He's also host of the Iowa History 101 series. It's a virtual learning series the second and fourth Thursdays of the month at noon. This Thursday, the Iowa State Fair. You can find out more at iowaculture.gov. And Tom Moraine is here from the History Department of Graceland University in Lamoni and former director of the State Historical Society of Iowa. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
On the road again. I just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. And I can't wait to get on the road again.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are taking a road trip through Iowa history, talking about how road tripping developed as a very important part of our culture, how road trips actually shaped the leisure landscape of Iowa, and of course, how they've changed over time as well. With me this hour, Tom Moraine from the History Department at Graceland University and former director of the State Historical Society of Iowa, and Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. And you are welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Leo, I want to go back to something that you mentioned earlier. You were talking about Idlewild in Michigan, which was a resort for African Americans at the time. And as this culture developed and people were traveling across the country, the problem of segregation and discrimination was just huge for African-American travelers because there were a lot of places that would not accept them. And in Iowa, there, as everywhere else, there also developed some places that were designed specifically for African-American travelers.
Exactly right. And a lot of the listeners will be familiar with the film Green Book, which if you were traveling, if you were African American and traveling across the United States, you could use the Green Book to identify where safe or welcoming places would be. And in response to those challenges, Cecil and Evelyn Reed of Cedar Rapids had some property along the Lincoln Highway, just east of Cedar Rapids. And in 1953, Cecil had been operating a flourishing floor finishing business. That was how he made his income. And so they converted what had been part of their storage facility into the Motel Sepia. And it lasted for a few years. And when you were an African American, if you saw words like Lincoln or Sepia just as you were traveling, you probably knew that was a safe place for you to stop. And so Cecil and Evelyn Reed operated. It had, I think, four rooms. It had a sign outside, and the Cedar Rapids Gazette really did a nice piece on it in 1953, and it did last. And then Cecil Reed had a really prominent career in Iowa and actually played some roles in national political activity. So he was our first African-American legislator from Iowa. So a really compelling story about how Iowans were addressing challenges. He had taken a trip, their family had taken a trip to Denver the year before or so, and he had seen how difficult at times it was to get accommodations. And so he wanted people to know if they were traveling through Iowa on the Lincoln Highway in the 1950s, that it was open to anyone, but with using the name of Motel Sepia, you knew as an African-American traveler, if you were coming from Chicago along the Lincoln Highway, that that was going to be a welcoming place.
And of course, many Iowans also opened up their homes. African-American Iowans would run sort of boarding houses to give people a place to stay. I know that when the famous Olympian Jesse Owens traveled to Iowa, he couldn't stay in a hotel. He stayed in a private home, a person who regularly opened up their home to travelers. So this was a deeply embedded system in Iowa and everywhere else in the country as well. I want to talk about Iowa's state parks, and we're going to do an in-depth show about the state parks in just a couple of weeks because, of course, we are celebrating the centennial of the state parks in Iowa. But, Tom, I'll let you kick this off. The development of the state parks in Iowa, the reason we're celebrating 100 years, that was really closely tied in many ways to the automobile, right?
Yeah, for when people could travel to fairly local spots and have a preserved nature area. We have some wonderful natural spots around the state, Northeast Iowa with rock outcroppings, the ledges in Boone and so forth. And the one of the early challenges, of course, and it remains with us, is how do you open up these natural areas to heavy human traffic and still preserve their natural settings, so that from the very earliest days and of the the state parks, you have that question of let's bring in people to have a place that they can safely enjoy nature that is accessible to them, but also how do we preserve that spot for future generations?
Well, and we know that our state parks were profoundly shaped by the Conservation Corps during the Great Depression and the New Deal that followed. So I can imagine that some of those early roads were not nearly as nice as the ones that we drive on, Tom.
No, but your mention of the CCC program, the Civilian Conservation Program, that took late teenage boys, early 20s, fed them, clothed them, housed them, and put them to work on conservation projects to improve the parks. And we still have many, many examples of their good work in picnic shelters, in landscaping, and they probably did some occasional work on roads where it was necessary. With the coming, though, of the automobile, the responsibility for roads had to shift because it used to be that the farm family, was essentially responsible for the roads around its own farmstead. So the more you did on your roads, the better you traveled, at least locally. But when travel became much more important from town to town, you couldn't just leave it to the local farm family. If it was a muddy spot and they weren't interested in maintaining it, somebody had to be responsible. And gradually, responsibility for the roads moved from the township to the county to the state. And with each step, there was often very strong political resistance, saying, "You can't take away control of our roads."
As the state parks developed, Leo, you can jump in here as well. Of course, you know, we know that Backbone State Park is the oldest of the state parks in Iowa. So as this movement grew, more state parks were added, and we've had state park property added in recent years as well. Leo, what were some of the really popular outdoor destinations?
Sure. Through the 1920s, you start seeing the parks added in greater and greater numbers. You have Lacey Keosauqua, also an early one down in southeast Iowa. Stone State Park, just north of Sioux City, is added in 1935 as part of that Depression era. And also, the Conservation Commission was mindful of making opportunities available to people across the state. The area around the Iowa Great Lakes and also Clear Lake, some of that land gets purchased by the state and made into state park land as well. Then later in the century, you see places like Prairie Rose State Park in Shelby County. And that really was, you know, the Luss Hills in northwest Iowa, as we said, Stone State Park north of Sioux City. You've got Preparation Canyon, which is, I think, now a preserve, but is just a marvelous location near Onawa. And I had the chance in 1996, the sesquicentennial year, to survey park records while I was a grad student. And that was one of my favorite summer road trips, was traveling across the state to the state parks.
And I know a lot of people are trying to hit all the state parks this year again in our centennial year, and they've been very popular again, although that was really problematic in March and April as state park bathrooms, et cetera, were closed. So this has been a challenging year to celebrate that centennial. And as I mentioned, we are going to spend a great deal more time in about 2 weeks, we'll spend an hour talking specifically about the centennial of the state parks and how they developed in some of the parks in particular. So you'll have that to look forward to. But I want to move on. Tom, let's talk a little bit about the car culture that developed in the 1940s and the 1950s. So we had gotten used to road trips, but in the 40s and 50s, it seems like we wanted to spend even more time in our cars and drive everywhere and go out to dinner and stay in our cars. Let's talk about that culture.
Well, I can do a family story on that. In 1949, the Moraine family piled into one Ford, 1949 Ford, and headed north to Brainerd, Minnesota, with nine of us in the car. Our one set of grandparents and one grandmother, and then four children and two parents. My spot was in the ledge behind the back seat under the rear window because I was 2 years old and could fit there. And then the
so
other eight arranged
you in.
Themselves.
Okay.
Yeah. And we went up and had a cabin, Brainerd, Minnesota. And it was my first encounter with an outhouse. And several years later, we had another encounter with an outhouse. And I told my parents, this smells like Minnesota, which became a family joke from then on.
But apologies to all Minnesotans listening right now.
That's right. But you didn't take two or three cars. You took one car, and you suffered the inconvenience when you went. But you made do. Then there was the whole culture of trailers, the Airstream trailers, the tent trailers that would fold out later, and just being homes on the road became not all that unusual. But gas prices were low, the cars were getting bigger and bigger, and we were simply devoted to the automobile in the 40s and 50s.
I want to get to the phone. Seth is on the line in Independence. Hi, Seth.
Hello.
Hi, you've got a road trip story for us?
I do. I had a really good time. This was maybe 10 or 15 years ago, but a friend of mine and I had spent some time on Clear Lake with his family, water skiing and whatnot. And we lived in Cedar Rapids at the time, and we were making our way back from Mason City, or just east of Mason City, to Cedar Rapids, and we decided to take an alternative route that took us. We followed first the Rock River, and then we jumped over to the Cedar River, but we took mostly back roads, and every time we had an opportunity to cross over the river, so we were going back and forth across the river at every bridge that we could find. And took probably about 6 hours to make that, normally, an hour or so.
Wow.
But it was a great day, and I always remember that. So it's a simple thing, and the other thing about living here in Iowa that I've always enjoyed is if you have the time, you can virtually go, really a few miles from your home in any direction and see things that you probably never even seen before, just taking routes that you don't normally take. So,
Seth, thanks
anyway,
so much for the call. Yeah, what a great reminder to get off the main roads. And we have another great experience shared from Dan. He says, this is not an Iowa road trip experience, but in 1963, my family traveled from outside Chicago to Arizona with stops in Texas and Colorado before returning. Two memorable items. One, the air conditioner my dad purchased for the car was just a water tank that hung outside the passenger window and contained a spring-operated fan/paddle that was supposed to evaporate the water and blow the cooled air into the car. It did not send any cool air, but rather a shower of water over all passengers. And then his second memory, he says, the passage through the White Mountains in either New Mexico or Arizona, the road wound up and down the mountainside with stopping points at various spots to either cool the radiator or the brakes, depending on which way you were going. going. These points often looked directly down to lower parts of the highway and always had signs posted asking that we not drop stones on the cars below. He says, this was my most memorable road trip, and I'll never have another trip like it again. And we only have a couple of minutes left. And Leo, let's talk just briefly about drive-ins. Drive-in restaurants, drive-in theaters were all the rage in the 1950s. Again, we're seeing a little bit of a resurgence right now because people can't really be in theaters at the moment. But most of those old drive-ins are gone.
They are. There were over 70 drive-ins across the state in towns like Shenandoah or Haywarden in northwest Iowa, you know, over to the eastern side of the state. And there still are four drive-ins in Iowa. So one in Newton here in central Iowa, Bluegrass, just a little west of Davenport, and Delmar, which is near Maquoketa, north of DeWitt, and then up in Dickinson County, just east of Spirit Lake, there's the 71 drive-in. It has a long history, but there's been a resurgence in some of these. So you did the Waterloo Starlights, the earliest one I know of, starting in 1947. I happened to live diagonal from a drive-in when I was a boy, so I have fond drive-in movie.
That's funny. I lived just up the road from the Hillcrest drive-in in Cedar Falls when I was a kid, and every time we drove past, we'd crane our heads to see the movie just for a few minutes. But those are a thing of the past, although a lot of places are putting up inflatable screens right now, inviting people in Iowa City out to the airport. There are parking lots being turned into drive-ins. So what's old is new again in that way as well. And I think a lot of people will be experiencing road trips this summer. We only have about a minute left. Tom, if somebody's going on a road trip this summer as a historian, do you have any advice for them, a way to get to know the landscape or the history of where they're traveling?
Well, you can certainly look in advance. The Department of Cultural Affairs has an Iowa app that has historical and cultural things, locations in whatever town you're going to, and it's a wonderful resource. But I think my advice would be, it's not just the destination, it's the trip. Enjoy the trip. Plan to spend time. Don't say, we've got an hour and a half to get there and we have to push. Give yourself time to enjoy the countryside. And I really do like the idea of get off the interstates, get into the backcountry and look at the wonderful diverse features of this state. There's a lot here, and a lot of them are just hidden treasures.
Oh, well, Tom, thank you so much. That's wonderful advice. Tom Moraine, take care.
Thank you.
Leo Landis, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Great to be with you and Tom.
Leo Landis is the curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Tom Moraine is from the History Department at Graceland University in Lamoni and former director of the State Historical Society of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe.